So no thoughts about the Gospels? Thomas, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's what you covered, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I thought it was fascinating that Mark was short, brief, to the point, and a lot of the details were filled in as years went by.
Yes, it's the shortest one.
Yeah.
And considered.
And sort of like what happened.
Shortest canonical.
Elaborate, right. Elucidate. Thank you.
Yes. Well, for example, people started saying, well, where was he born and where did he come from? And you know, so then they had to create birth stories. And
well, and the longer it went from the release of the beginning of the dissemination of Mark's gospel.
Well, then they recovered two different ones.
The longer it went from after Mark's gospel began to be distributed, more people got their hands on it and had things they wanted to add. But I remember when he did this. And, you know, so.
Well, and they also talk about that probably Thomas was existent as a...
Thomas and Q were probably
and Q,
there.
And then Mark telling basic stories, and so then you have those three sources, and then...
I kind of like that Thomas guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he didn't tell a story. He just, you know, listed the sayings, which they think Q was probably pretty much a sayings. I wonder if Thomas is going to affect how they see Q. Because Q, they never found Q. They just assumed there was a Q because there were common things that all three synoptic gospels had that they figured there had to be a source.
Well, it was more than an assumption. A lot of scholarly research went into identifying specific passages. In fact, I think it's in a book called The Lost Gospel. They actually reproduce what they think Q contained.
But that was before they had Thomas.
It's all surmise from... No, yes, they had Thomas. Yeah.
They had Thomas when
Q,
they...
When that book was written, we did, yeah.
Oh, when that book... But Q was surmised quite a while ago, before Thomas.
Yeah.
Q stood for quell. It's a German word, which is just source.
Oh.
So they just call it the Q gospel. It wasn't something that existed, as Dan was saying. It was something that they sort of created by looking at these common statements that appeared in the other Gospels, they assumed there had to be a common source for them. So
because the wording was very similar and the sequences were similar and so forth.
I have not seen an analysis based on the existence of Thomas that would go back to Q. And they're different,
pretty much different.
Yeah. Okay.
I have one more question.
Q is just Q, but it stands for Q-U-E-L-L, I believe.
E.
So it's just
an
E-L-L-E.
Quella.
Yeah, but then the Q comes from, it's just Q, but it stands for the German word.
Q-U-E-L-L-E?
Yeah,
it's French.
It is, but the German word, Quella, and I think in French, Quell, doesn't Quell mean witch?
Yes.
Yes, so it's a different word.
How do you know that?
I studied French.
But you're right.
In German, it means source, though.
In German, it means source.
Source, right. So.
I just wanted to ask about the two different Thomases, so that the doubting Thomas that we all know about is... separate from this Thomas who writes these, right? Did you say that it was a different Thomas?
Yeah.
I never said that, but that's true.
Okay.
We don't think the same Thomas who's the apostle wrote the Gospel of Thomas.
In the same way that none of the Gospels are written by the individuals that were the disciples that have their name on them.
Or by any one individual.
So it could have been just like Matthew and Mark, the people that happened to follow that church or something. Thomas probably had, if there was a Thomas, so it could have been his community that wrote that. So it is in reference to him. The name is in reference to the disciple Thomas, who would be the doubting Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the name there.
Luke and John were never apostles.
Well, Luke was never an apostle because... he wasn't Jewish and he wasn't there in the group.
He's
but
disciples.
He was one of the later, I don't know how you use apostles or disciples. Maybe he wasn't an apostle,
apostles
but
is
not.
Just the original 12 in church terminology.
And so, but the people who wrote the Gospels were not the people who followed Jesus because they weren't written until generations later. So they were probably, yes. So followers of those folks possibly writing in memory of those folks, but not...
decided they only have about a dozen names that they use.
Yeah.
Children being born.
Sometimes seemed that way, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
when
true now, too, if you think about it.
When I talked last week about the authorship, and I said that's a subject you just have to ignore because we don't really know anything. And I talked about that book called Who Wrote the New Testament. That book hypothesizes, and it's getting a lot of traction in scholarly ranks these days, that those books were all written by several different people pulling stories together, and then they had one editor in some cases, but not in every case. They had one editor who sort of made it all sound the same. John is one of those.
Right.
That it sounds really cohesively written from beginning to end. It's tightly organized and all that sort of stuff. But Matthew, for example, isn't. It's all over the place. So that could easily have been just a cut and paste job, you know. So,
except Spong finds a whole order in Matthew.
Well, the order, yeah, but not. But in terms of the languaging and style and so forth, yeah.
So, how many of you are reading the book? Not too many. Okay, that's fine. I mean, that's fine. I just wanted to know. Okay.
Yeah.
So this section that we're looking at tonight is called Gospel Poems and Songs Between Heaven and Earth. Did you talk about the odes at all?
Before? Nope.
So the odes of Solomon were a set of 41 songs that were similar to, they're very similar to Psalms. Interesting that the story of them discovering them, I read a few of them. It was sort of this absent-minded professor who found them on his desk, couldn't quite remember.
I did tell that story. Yeah,
didn't
right.
quite remember where he'd gotten them from, but remembered somebody giving them to him. Didn't know how long they'd been there, etc. But upon finally reading them, realized that it was like a almost complete set of the 41 Psalms that had been referred to in a lot of other writings, so they knew they existed. The only one missing is number 2.
Right.
And they don't know why. So there's no unified authorship, but they clearly represent, as the author of this book said, the reason that the New Orleans group put them is they really represent liturgy. So the kind of prayers and things that would have been said during their religious services, just the same way oftentimes you'll find how many times that the quotes in Daily Word are from Psalms, because they're just easy, user-friendly, if you want to call it, uplifting kinds.
Memorizable, too.
Memorizable and uplifting kinds of statements. Well, these are similar to that, but very Christian-oriented. So clearly the writers had a tradition of the Jewish Psalms to follow in, so they think that there's clearly a connection, but they're also very clearly Christian in origin, because they talk about, they place them in the first century, early second century, depends upon who you're talking to, as usual. They often have the Christ figure speaking, and then they have individuals like the follower speaking, and then they have the followers speaking in the voice of the Christ, so you get all of those different dimensions. And the Christ is also represented as a cosmic figure who connects humanity and God throughout the odes. There's that. So in this book, what he did was they decided that they wanted to divided them up into 4 books of odes, so they divided the 41 into 4 groups, and I guess they have sort of different themes. I'm not sure quite how they picked it, but they're just sort of in order. So they put like 1 through 12 is at the beginning of this group, and then they have a set of odes at the beginning of each of the sections of the New Testament, just like the prayer of Thanksgiving, that sort of sets a tone, that it would, believing that if you read them, it would sort of help you get into this sort of centered meditative state as you then read the rest of the scriptures of that section.
So, an ode is a praise to certain person?
An ode is just a poem.
Just a poem.
Right. There are lots of odes written by Shakespeare and Wordsworth and lots of other, Wordsworth and lots of other poets have written odes.
But these are spiritual.
These are spiritual
odes. And they're called the Odes of Solomon. If you recall that the Psalms were considered written by David, King David. And so again, in that tradition, saying the Odes of Solomon is sort of a following. And Solomon, the root word is connected to, clearly he represents wisdom and such, so they're sort of wisdom poems. And
and there is the Song of Solomon in the
right.
Hebrew scriptures too. So.
And that's the same guy, right?
Not the same writer.
No.
Not the same. Hundreds of years difference.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
At least. At least hundreds of years. Yeah. So Christian versus Solomon is way back before the first temple's destroyed. Before the disbursement of all the Jews all around them, such that, and so, yeah, very different time.
Mm-hmm. And poetry is a very specific kind of a poem, though. It's not just a poem. It's an honorific.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. It's, and aren't they usually brief in the same way that a haiku is brief or a limerick is brief?
It's not true of these. It's not true of these.
I don't know. The best known ode in English poetry, I think, is called Ode on a Grecian Urn.
Yes.
And I don't think that's, I think that's a fairly long piece, as I recall.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, it depends on what you mean.
What's a Grecian urn?
Type
about 10 drachmas a day.
Type of lyrical stanza.
10 drachmas a day.
Structured in three major parts. Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's why I have a lyric poem, typically of elaborate or irregular metrical form,
right,
and expressive of exalted or enthusiastic emotion.
Mm. Yep.
So.
They're originally poetic pieces performed with musical accompaniment.
Mm.
Also expresses a strong feeling of love or respect for someone or something. So that all fits because they're all to God and to Christ. So I thought what I would do, there's 12 that begin this chapter, and I just thought I would just read a couple, and then, you know, just you listen, and then we'll just talk about a little bit of what came to you from that. They're very positive and uplifting. And
so when were these written?
They believe in the first century, probably no later, which would be in the, you know, 80, 90, no later than about 120 is what they're guessing.
And who do they think?
I have no idea. Because there's a bunch of them, and so they could have been gathered, they could have been prayers that were done in a lot of the different places, and they gathered them together.
If you look at a modern church hymnal, all the hymns written by different people.
Okay.
However,
A.D., C.D., B.D.,
oh,
B.C.,
C.E., because after Christ, because they're Christian.
C.E. is A.D.
C.E., yeah. C.E. now means, so it's B.C.E. is before Common Era. B.C. didn't mean before Christ. It means before Common Era. Right? That's how we always remember it. And the Latin, I guess they used it in that form. But now what they say is B.C.E. is before Common Era. C.E. is Common Era on, which everybody in the Western world goes from Jesus' birth.
Except the Eastern Orthodox Church and a couple of
others. Seriously?
They just became more historically correct, yes. And it's not politically correct, but it was historically correct. Because CE is used in history beyond just the Christian church.
Right.
So it's related to more than, so it's a common era, but not just for Christians. So they came up with
when they adopted the Gregorian calendar, they had to have a demarcation for that, and they just drew that line there. So,
mm-hmm. So are these from the Nag Hammadi?
No.
No, they're not.
No.
Now, remember that?
This professor found them on his desk.
On his desk.
We
don't know where they came from.
And that was like, early 20th century.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, but they've been references to them and such. So. The other thing that you'll find in here is the Holy Spirit often is viewed as a female personification, which aligns with Sophia, who's also referred to in a lot of some of the New Testament.
And some of the rest of the stuff we're going to look at tonight.
Did you say Ophelia?
Sophia.
Sophia is the representation of wisdom in the scriptures. So. All right. So,
which one do you read?
Ode 1. I'm going to start right from the beginning. So just take a deep breath and get centered and open your hearts and minds. The Lord is upon my head like a crown, and I will not be without him. The crown of truth was braided for me and caused your branches to bloom within me. For it is not a barren crown that never blooms, But you live upon my head and blossom down upon me. Your fruits are full and overflowing. They are full of your salvation.
Clear imagery.
It is very clear imagery. As I read them, I went, wow, Unity could use
yes.
all of these.
I've been thinking, it's been going through here, that when we do the scriptures on Sunday morning, we can reach into the eyes. I know you use Sirach on Sunday. Yeah.
So what does that say to you? What images jump out?
A plant growing into your head.
That's not light.
What's the traditional image of a crown? Of thorns, right.
Yes.
Why is that the traditional image?
It's not mine, but it's not mine.
Well, the Christian.
Christian is. Yeah, related to the church. I would, when a crown is talked about, I think of the crown of thorns that Jesus wore.
And what's interesting, it says, for it is not a barren crown that never blooms. So think about the crown we normally think of these dried thorns interwoven that are, it's pretty much a dead thing that was like mockery, and yet we turned it into something else. But the images here say, it's not a barren crown that never blooms, but you live upon my head and blossom down upon me. What?
It's a very unity principle.
Yeah. Right.
God is all around and inside.
Yes, it's very much like many of the others, which is why I think they all got labeled Gnostic, is because they all talk about wisdom or knowledge being sort of the salvation, that what happens wasn't like just being the traditional of a Savior dying for our sins that we really don't have anything to do with, but really a transference of awareness, of awakening, of knowledge and such. And we're going to find that throughout most of these 10 books that have been added to the new, and most of the books, which is interesting because that was the alternative when they chose what books would be included. They tended to stay away from the ones that were really talking about it being about knowledge. And they focused on the one. And then they demonized them or made them heretical by saying they were about secret knowledge. And it was, you know, they turned it into looking like sorcery.
General, they were sort of getting away from the Old Testament that was sort of hellfire and damnation. So, were they, at least that's what my mother said.
That's a good Christian.
That's
a good Christian interpretation.
What?
It's not a very valid one, but
okay, well, that's what I need to put here. But yeah. It was always my understanding that the at least first books, first testament, were a little harder core, so to speak. And then as the New Testament sort of shook that up and became more positive and kind of thing. So wouldn't it fit into that sort of idea?
Yeah, there is some of that. My point, I guess, is that when they chose the books for the New Testament, though, they were choosing, because this is still a very positive image. They chose books that weren't that were focused more on faith and trust in the Lord doing
obedience.
It for us, rather than on us gaining some knowledge that would be what our salvation is.
And remember, at the time, everybody's illiterate. Priests are educated. And the rule was the people didn't read the Bible, weren't aware of what was in it. They only heard what the priest taught them. So any attempt to provide a document that the people could read, understand, and interpret was anathema. You just couldn't have that around, because then people would start believing their own followings, their own spiritual promptings and so forth, and the church would lose the power of the organizational hierarchy. So,
however, at the beginning when the church was forming, that's what they
exactly,
had.
That's what they
was
exactly
all
they
kinds
had.
Of folks with all their own ideas.
Only when they tried to centralize
and then
it.
When it became political and it was no longer a spiritual movement, but it became Constantine saying, okay, for the state, I'm going to choose this to be my church, which means you got to decide what it's going to mean. You got to say it isn't that. And what I'd really like you to do is make sure that the Romans don't get blamed for killing Jesus, and that we can keep people in line with this, because that's the whole point of having it. I doubt that he said it quite those words, but it could have been very close to that.
Could have been a cool subtext anyway.
And so what you get is they eliminate all the things that had people think for themselves and bring them into.
But doesn't it exist even today?
Well, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm. absolutely.
Doesn't that same problem exist today? He said.
Well, that's what the church, the history of the church has been that.
Right.
And so it started open, it closed, and then it stayed closed for quite a period of time, and then Luther started the whole thing coming open again when he's, you know, putting the Bible in the native languages so people could read it themselves was what blew it all up. You know, so the Reformation was the beginning of the end of the control.
I feel that, especially Revelation, and the point is when you read parts of the Bible, especially Revelation for me, it's a symbol of control and people in order.
Well, the interpretation of Revelation.
That's what I'm saying.
The interpretation of Revelation that was promoted by the church definitely fit into all that. So the how it was, again, that comes back to only the priests and the church could interpret what it meant. You know, if you really go back, and it's a metaphysical book, and if you go back and look at all the images, it's also pretty timely because it's representing, you know, the different rulers that were in charge at the time and the different nations that had collapsed in the time, you know, and so all of that is imagery, but the church turned it into very much a heaven and earth kind of apocalyptic writing.
There's another way of I'm stuck with Crown. I want to go back to Crown. There's another way of interpreting Crown, and that is as a golden diadem with gems, and if one sees it as that in their own imagery, sees it as that, the ode still works because Jesus rejected a worldly crown, and we don't have to go to his crucifixion for the crown of thorns. We can just look at the golden crown that would imply not the fruits which are referred to in the ode, but power and control over. And that's what he rejected. And the people that were following him were urging him to take on that political position, is according to the stories.
Right. Except that this set is actually a positive about a crown. So if it's the golden crown, then...
But couldn't it be like the golden light?
Well, the reason for me it comes to the crucifixion crown is because it was braided. The crown of truth was braided for me. And so that doesn't bring a little metal band that brings the thorns that were braided.
Well, I couldn't help just right away thinking of the crown chakra, you know, where...
Well, sure. It definitely fits the crown chakra in terms of the Lord is upon me and the knowledge comes through me and all of that sort of thing. Absolutely fits into that image. So the other piece of Gnosticism, so we think of often, if you're not aware of, haven't gone deep into it, Gnosticism is that, you know, salvation comes through knowledge. But the other aspect of Gnosticism that has now made them go back and revisit that is it also is sort of like Course in Miracles, that the material world doesn't really exist. And so it's all illusion. And so then there's argument over whether these and the other two that I'm going to be talking about tonight are really Gnostic or not. And so there's more elements than just knowledge being the answer in Gnosticism, that as to whether or not it really belonged to the school of Gnosticism. So just to be aware of that. Okay, the other one I went ahead. Try not to do ones that are too long, but actually the first few give a pretty good sense. So this is ode number 3. I put on the love of the Lord, and his members are with him, and I am raised up by them, and he loves me. Indeed, I would not have known how to love the Lord except that he had continually loved me. Who is able to recognize love except the one who has been loved? I cherish the beloved, and my whole self loves him, and wherever his rest is, I am also there. I will not be rejected, because there is no suspicion with the Lord, the Most High and compassionate. I have been joined to the Lord because the lover has found the one who is beloved. Because I love the one who is the child, I will become a child. Truly, whoever is united to the one who does not die, neither will he die. And the one who delights in the life will become alive. This is the Spirit of the Lord, who is not deceitful, who instructs humanity so that they might recognize his paths, be wise, understanding, and awakened. Hallelujah.
That is so new.
In a more traditional language, and yet very, very unity, yeah.
If you dig down.
Yeah. If you were looking to put unity in biblical writing.
We haven't purchased the book. Is there a place that we can get these? Are they
online? Yes, online. Yeah. They're online, though not necessarily this interpretation, because I went online looking at, for other interpretations of these, and the, all of the, almost all of the Gnostic, you can find them if you.
There's actually one website that collects all the best translations of all of these books that we're dealing with, and lots of others.
You want to use
I spent a lot of my life there.
You want to use my, because Sue has one. And
are, is there going to be a handout?
For the books that I'm covering tonight, there is,
okay.
Yeah.
After you hand that out, will you tell me what the website is so I can write it down?
Actually, I Googled, like, Gospel of Truth or, you know, Gospel of Mary and or Gnostic Gospel of Truth because it's harder to find the Gospel of Truth. There isn't nearly as much
but
about it.
And,
right, yeah.
So we can't get these in church?
You can buy these at on Amazon.
On Amazon. Amazon Smile.
Smile.
Amazon Smile.
Amazon Smile with the proceeds coming to Unity Church.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Somebody, you
right.
Told me. I remember that.
So what other images came out in that? There's some very traditional Christian things about there that if you accept, you know, eternal life.
Unconditional love.
Unconditional love. In one of the commentaries I read about it where he says, wherever his rest, I'm also there. I will not be rejected because there is no suspicion with the Lord. Another interpretation says there's no jealousy
right.
with the Lord. So it's like a direct counterpoint to the Hebrew scriptures that say, I'm a jealous
unconditional
God, right? So.
Now you shall not have any other gods before me. What about that?
That doesn't necessarily suggest jealousy. You know, that could also just be, you know, be true to the truth as opposed to it gets it, you know, it depends on where you're coming from. if what you've been pounded is that this is a jealous God who's if you don't worship him you're going to be punished and that
right.
sort of thing, it's a very different orientation than almost all of these and certainly what Unity would teach about that. For me, that's a God with a huge ego, and that would be the opposite of God for my experience.
So am I understanding I keep hearing the word he as though
yeah.
God is a human and it's not, and if it's all energy, all divine spirit.
Right.
So where does this he come from? And then why is not no she or
actually,
or whatever?
Actually, in
how
some
many
of the
classes we have
in these scriptures,
I
one
see
thing.
People talk about this all the time in Unity.
Well, in Unity,
place,
we
not to say,
try not to say, the only time I use he in Unity is when I'm reading a scripture and then that's what the scripture said. And even then, try to adjust those. But Fillmore used he because he grew up at a time when
exactly.
he was the universal
right.
word for humanity.
Right.
And so now we're much more sensitive about trying to, and this author tends to be very inclusive, central, and only uses he when it's clearly speaking about a he. So when they're talking about Jesus, they're going to talk about a he.
But when
but when they're talking about God, they do refer to Father, but they refer to Mother. They do refer to, you'll find there's references we're going to see to energy, to
but oftentimes we
uncontained.
Refer to more than one person at a time.
Right.
It's the male gender. It is. I mean, by
you mean when you refer to one,
when you're looking
a
at
singular.
Grammar, when you're looking at grammar
in
right.
other language,
in other, yeah.
Yeah.
In
it's
singular, but yeah.
Well, it's singular, and it's also when you pluralize it, so to speak.
See, but when you pluralize it, actually when you pluralize is when you can get away from it, because then you go to they, and they is inclusive.
In English,
but yes,
but
not in, yeah.
Right.
So.
But I don't think that it's hard to get in the mind of
I hear you, because I speak English, but.
Right,
but
we're coming from a different.
But. It is in other languages.
Well,
yeah,
and for
15 men and one
woman.
No, 15 women
and
one
man,
it's still ellos.
Yes.
The
exactly.
masculine form.
Exactly.
It's grammar.
Well,
it's
we
grammar.
Talk about, in fact, in this ode that you just read, the word that he translates or that was translated by the translator in verse 10, who instructs humanity, he makes a footnote that in the original that literally means, is literally translated sons of men.
Right, but he changed.
And a number of years ago there was a big discussion about whether we should change the word humanity because they had the word man in it, which I always thought was a little too far, but still, there was a lot of people who were concerned about that.
Well, it has human.
It
has human in it. It's for human.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too, but, you know, I lost a lot of arguments.
But
I got the claw marks to show it, too.
But interesting, if you look at the conclusion, be wise, understanding, and awakened. There's also a lot of awakened references in here, which is much more, again, that sort of could be compared to the Buddhist.
The cloak?
The cloak?
Or the robe? Wasn't there?
I didn't remember anything about a robe.
Okay, never mind. I'm sworn I heard that somewhere.
All right, so just we'll be looking at those as we go and reading a couple at the beginning of the each section. So are we going in the order of this then? So you want to do the thunder again?
Right, and then I'll do the thunder
we'll go back
and then you'll do the
other
one. Yeah.
Is very helpful, I think. It implies that if we always have access to God within, which knows the whole truth and sees us holistically, and therefore there's no room for self-doubt.
You don't need one.
We can right away recognize the potential eviction of the ego.
Yes, it also... A lot of these talk about that they're, you know, the whole idea of sin and that where that came from, and these books tend to not come from a place of original sin. And, you know, at least the ones I did this week.
So I'm going to do the next two books in this section, the first of which is called The Thunder, Perfect Mind, and the second of which is the Gospel of John from the Canonicals.
First one we could have used for Sunday's lesson.
Yes,
we
could have. So, The Thunder of Perfect Mind is an interesting manuscript. There's only one copy of it that is nearly complete, and it was found at Nag Hammadi. There's no mention of this book in any other New Testament era literature that we know about. So there's no record of other people referring to it or referencing it or arguing about it or anything else. Scholars think it was probably composed in Egypt, although they originally thought it was composed in Greek. They've now been more and more of them are switching over to the belief that it was probably authored in Coptic and then translated into Greek. Coptic is the Egyptian language. Like the Odes of Solomon, Thunder, Perfect Mind is very poetic in its form and content. And there's no way to pin down the date because there's no historical references in this document. But so it ranges all over the map from anywhere from 1st century BCE to the 3rd century CE. So when it was written, it turns out not to be knowable or necessarily at all that useful. It's interesting to note from a structural perspective that chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, form a sort of prologue. And which maps very closely to the prologue that appears in John, and particularly John 1:10, where the world that comes into being through the Logos, or Word, we're going to spend more time on John later, doesn't recognize or acknowledge truth. So in the first part of the text of The Thunder of Perfect Mind, we get, I was sent out from power. I came to those pondering me. And I was found among those seeking me. Look at me, all you who contemplate me. Audience, hear me. Those expecting me, receive me. Don't chase me from your sight. Don't let your voice or your hearing hate me. Don't ignore me. Don't ignore me any place, any time. Be careful. Do not ignore me. I am the first and the last. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I'm the limbs of my mother. I'm a sterile woman, and she has many children. That flavor keeps coming through here. We're going to go over a lot more of that stuff before we're
paradoxal.
Done.
Paradoxal, yes.
Very much so. Yeah, we're in a lot of paradoxes.
Paradoxal and holistic, so I'm everything.
Yeah, that's right. As you compare the thunder of perfect mind with the content of the canonical Gospels, a couple of interesting things come out. One is that the content and format of this book are nothing like anything that's in any of the canonicals, including John. There's no other book that looks, sounds, or reads like this in any of the New Testament literature, canonical or non-canonical, that we know about. Jesus or the Christ is never mentioned. The words never appear in this.
What is the age or time difference of that Agamati? How far back and how far forward? Is there
the whole span?
Yeah, time.
I don't think anybody could put, because you can't put an end date on it, but they probably date to 1st century CE, because they're all Christian documents. There's no Hebrew stuff there. Mm-hmm. So from 1st century CE, maybe late 1st century CE, up to the 3rd or 4th.
Mm-hmm. They don't go back into BC.
No, that's all. That stuff was all found at
Dead
Sea Scrolls of Qumran. Yeah, yeah, right. Interestingly, the whole thing is told mostly from first person. So it's I, and it's addressing you.
And it's a feminine voice.
And it's a feminine voice, but it's also there's some place where it's male.
Yeah.
One of the interesting quotes in the introduction is that thunder's divine voice speaks simultaneously of its own deep pain and its glorious boldness. You read that in Thunder. You read that in John, and there's some of that in Matthew, where we get this contrast between a confident Savior, confident God, and this institution being assaulted from all sides and so forth. And that theme sort of recurs here. You'll see that a couple of places. Then, as Vicki said, the narrator speaker refers to itself mostly in the feminine, but occasionally switches gender. Some of the scholars who are looking at this think that it's probably the case that it was all female, and that somewhere along the line, Coptic translation switched the gender on some of the verses because feminine in the context of the verse didn't make sense to them. But we don't have the original, so we don't know for sure. So,
if Jesus is not mentioned in this anywhere at all, what does this have to do with?
Hopefully you'll see soon.
Okay.
And the theory is that this is actually, it sounds like Jesus talking. A lot of the teachings and sentiments that are in this very, very interesting and complicated book are very much Jesus and Christian teachings. So even though he's not mentioned, the teachings are very, very early church teachings.
Well, and the whole thing with what Dan was just talking about, that there's this glorious winning, glorious boldness, and then also this humility and humiliation and such that keep coming, which Jesus went through. So he was, he was crucified, which was the worst of the worst, and also so there's that kind of dichotomy.
A lot of the gospel of this particular book, it's not a gospel, but this particular book consists of I am statements, which are also very characteristic of John. In fact, this book is primarily I am statements, even when they don't read that way. If you look back at the construct, it's usually an I am origination there. So there are some really cryptic and paradoxical ones in here that we'll look at in a little bit. But these I am statements come in groups that are interspersed among warnings, pleas, humiliations, and other directions or requests of the audience. So the book is clearly addresses an audience. At the beginning, it mentions audience, and near the end, it mentions audience. When I read that a minute ago, you may have picked that up. Audience, hear me. Those expecting me, receive me. So clearly, this book is addressed at an audience, a group of people. We don't know who that group is, but we do know that they're probably Christian in terms of their philosophy. But then, and so that was kind of a warning thing. And then, so you go along for a while, and then there's all these I ams, I'm this and I'm that and so forth. And then there's this kind of thing. Pay attention to me, to my impoverishment and to my extravagance. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile. That's actually a translation. Leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms. So it's a lot of conflicting emotion kind of things going on. Don't put me down. this is where I'm going to be, this is, I mean, there's a lot of that which feels kind of psychological almost in some ways. A very few of the I am statements in this book have parallels or similar sentiments to those that are in John, but not very many as it turns out. One of them is in chapter 3, verse 7, and I should pause here and say that chapters and verses in this thing have been added very modernly because the manuscript they got originally didn't have any of those, and they've been put in just to make it easy to refer to them. So there's no significance to the fact that two items appear in
just
the same
verse. It's the same reason they were put into the original.
Exactly, by some kind of train. 3:7 says, I am she whom they call, no, I'm sorry. I am she whom they call life. And you all called death, which is sort of parallel to John's statement that he is life or the life. That nobody comes to the eternal life but through him.
Every statement in here is a paradoxical.
Almost statement. All, not all of them, but a huge
like
part of it. In the early going, almost all of them are, and then he switches out of that somewhere. 3:13, I am without God, and I am she whose God is magnificent.
Say that again.
I am without God, and I am she whose God is magnificent.
Paradox.
Sort of similar to when Jesus said something like, those who have seen me have seen the Father.
Yeah.
Or the Father and I are one. There's this connection between us. But I tried to figure this out. I can't find any authority on it. I am without God. Does that mean I don't have God, or does that mean I'm outside of God? Without. I don't know which meaning is intended there. And then there's an appendix on this. That
well, if it's a paradox, what would it be?
Could be either. If it's a paradox. I don't know if there's a paradox in that particular case. Yes. But not everything is. An appendix, the last verse in the appendix, which is the end of this thing, says, they will live and they will not die again. Which is really consistent with Jesus and John's descriptions of eternal life coming through this being, this entity.
I would encourage you to Google this and read it if you haven't, just because it's just very poetic and huh?
So
it's not that long.
I'm going to read you. I'm going to read you a few of these. They're all really short. I'm going to read you a few of these and just pause for a minute to let you reflect on it. If you have anything that pops in here you want to share, feel free, but you may not. They may just be interesting. You might have a hard time following along the book because I'm skipping around a lot. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I am the limbs of my mother. I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. In that last one, I think she refers to the mother. So that's not a paradox, you see. I could be sterile, and my mother could still have many children. Okay, that's one.
Say it again, please.
I am a sterile woman, and she has many children. Preceding verse said, I am the limbs of my mother. So I'm suggesting that she reflects back as a pronoun, reflects back to mother.
I don't know either.
I'm just hypothesizing. And there's no way of knowing for sure. So.
And there's no punctuation.
It's sterile.
There's no punctuation in this whole thing. You know?
But it is sterile, and she is the mother. And to even take sterile as though, the way this is speaking, as though this is a spirit being.
Could be, right?
Spirit.
Could
being,
be, yeah.
And therefore, you can't have children being a spirit being.
Could be.
So that's what a sterile seem like comes into me.
Right. But why?
Yet there are many children.
Right.
And yet many children.
But it's of the spirit realm, so to speak.
You could be right about that. It's an interesting interpretation. I hadn't thought about that. I am the slave woman of him who served me. I am she, the Lord of my child. But it is he who gave birth to me at the wrong time, and he is my child born at the right time.
What is this all for? Doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense.
Remember
it's just
what
to
we
make
talked about. Oftentimes, scriptures are all about getting your mind to not make sense, so you just stop trying to figure it out. And you know, there it would be a thing
that's
to listen to in meditation.
If
that's
you
what it's saying to me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you think about
you can't
this,
separate. You
if,
can't
if,
say
if,
this is sacred and this
right.
is profane. Because
right.
if you think about this, if you think about this and imagine what's happening is that Jesus is describing himself or herself or itself as spirit here, trying to get across to humanity the precise nature of his being. And there's no words because it can't be described. It's ineffable. Words are bad, are just weak pointers to ideas that aren't adequate to describe. So this writer is trying all these different ways to say, these are the qualities that I have. These are the things that I have. And then of course, they're going to turn out to be somewhat nonsensical to us because it isn't rational.
He also talks about a lot of these things he's naming. If you came from a Hebrew background, the whole Hebrew tradition is unclean and unclean.
Right.
And he's basically saying, I'm all these things you call clean, and I'm all these things you call unclean.
Yeah, sure.
So he's sort of negating what the
right.
whole tradition
That's
of Judaism was broken down
yeah.
on mm-hmm. on clean and unclean and separation and everything, and he's saying no,
it's all one.
It's yes,
all one.
Yes,
which makes
which
us
he also,
all one,
right? Which is what he also stood for
right.
in terms of he had dinner with everybody and he refused to recognize the holiness
yeah.
laws. So
enumerating
the
ages,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one. I am the speaking of my name. I am the speaking of my name. I am both awareness and obviousness. I am humiliation and pride.
He's all of it.
Yin yang,
yes.
both and.
Mm-hmm.
I am security and I am fear.
Mm-hmm.
I am war and peace. Mm-hmm. That last one is reminiscent of the, when we read about Jesus says he came to bring peace, but he also set family members against one another.
And came as a sword.
So there's all that kind of paradox we're comfortable with in the canonical gospels. I myself am compassionate, and I am cruel. Watch out. I am the wisdom of the Greeks and the knowledge of the barbarians. I am the deliberation of both the Greeks and the barbarians. And then here in the next verse, this is now in chapter 3. We have, I am he whose image is multiple in Egypt, and she who is without an image among the barbarians. So that's one of the places where we get this gender mix crossover that we don't exactly know what to do with, but that could be a translation issue, but it could be deliberate on the part of the original author. Let's see, maybe one or two more. I thought this was the gods in God according to my design, and spirits of all men who exist with me, and the women who live in me. That sounds like an all-encompassing, unifying, spiritual entity being, doesn't it?
Like you're speaking of the divine feminine and the divine
yeah.
masculine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Comes in there, yeah. Yeah. And then this is one of my favorites because it's sufficiently mystical to be confusing as hell. I am being. I am she who is nothing.
I'm all.
So.
I also like this one. Since what is your inside is your outside, and the one who shapes your outside is he who shaped your inside. And what you see on the outside, you see revealed on the inside. It is your clothing.
That was the next one I was going to read. Perfect. Perfect.
Like Jesus supposedly talks sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
again, he's trying to break people out of their normal thinking that to get exactly where Michael went, like, what? You know, and that's sort of where they want a spiritual teacher
it's
wants
like
you to be uncomfortable and not being able to figure it out because then the next thing they say can land.
Right. And the last one that I'll share with you that I find really interesting from a number of perspectives is, I am what everyone can hear and no one can say.
That's deep.
I thought so.
Well, that's mystical.
I am what everyone can hear and no one can say.
Yes.
So.
No one can say.
So now, as we said a few minutes ago, there's a lot of paradox in here, obviously.
That makes a little sense.
Vicki, as Vicki taught Sunday, a key part of the mystical path is celebrating that paradox. And as she also teaches, every spiritual paradox we encounter is an invitation to shift to a higher level of consciousness, to reconcile the seeming paradox in a higher truth. So maybe we should take one of these or two of these, just a couple of minutes, and see if we can resolve the paradox in a higher truth that works for us.
So, an easy one.
Pick
don't give us the one about the Baron and the Sun.
I am peace. I am peace, and war exists because of me.
That's a hard one.
Ooh. ISIS?
What's the higher truth there? I'm not saying that's wrong.
I am.
Right?
Yeah. Well, not from this statement, that sort of. I mean, most wars start over our human, trying to bring these down to human levels and defending them and bringing our egos into it as opposed to understanding them. So in the material world, these truths cause war.
Right.
I was going to say, is it something as simple as, you know, this is sort of a new gig here, and these other people don't necessarily line up with it, so by my preachings or my teachings, I'm bringing other people in opposite, you know, they're opposing this, so I'm bringing war.
That's a reconciliation, and the idea that war exists because of me suggests that Jesus, or if, assuming this is Jesus talking, that Jesus didn't see himself as a pathway to world peace because he knew he was a controversial figure. He interfered with the government.
Right.
He was not going to be widely, he was not going to be 100% universally accepted and so forth, even though he's deity, even though he's divine. So you could do that. But those are just reconciliations. What's the higher truth? What's the spiritual principle that encompasses both of those ideas? Is there one? Maybe there isn't. I'm not suggesting there is. I'm just saying, there one?
What I get from that is it seems like you're saying that, because when you look at history, it's always been wars. It's always been fighting, all gun against right, what is true, what is not true. So in the beginning, you was reading about this all-encompassing. So it's still saying the same thing to me. It's like if you want to go say they created a Satan, a devil. So I'm saying to myself, well, if God is all there is, creator, then God must be all good. All of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that is saying to me.
Okay.
That is just all one.
So God
is
all.
Be.
The principle you get out of that is God is everything. God is all. Okay.
Which is on Sunday you talked about that we have to include, which we tend not to want to, the darkness.
Right.
In order to have the light, there has to be the yin yang about that, and that's also the creative process. If we define God as creation, creation has both.
Mm-hmm.
Of creation and destruction. Because things destroy in order to recreate, to keep that process going. And in Hindu, the Shiva, Shakti, that whole dynamic, there's always a creation and destruction are both part of the process.
So it may just be because of my own years of study and teaching the principle of oneness that this comes about. But as I read over this book, and I read it three times in close succession and then studied parts of it, I got the message that you're talking about, that this the message that here is oneness.
Yeah.
And it comes through in every single section, verse, chapter, and so forth, but really radically differently in all those places. And it's like an attempt, you know, so I likened it to the fact that sometimes when Vicki and I are speaking on Sunday or teaching, we'll say something like this. Well, God, divine mind, higher consciousness, spirit, we'll go
into
some very
names.
Different analogies, you know. and we don't mean to say, we're trying to explain what it means to us because it's not something that's easy to describe in a single word or phrase that everybody's going to get the same meaning from. And that's the same situation Jesus finds himself when he's trying to teach his identity, his what he is, what his nature is, so that the people who are following him can get some understanding of how they then ought to be. So
it's almost like saying, like if you will, Jesus saying to all, don't worry, children, we're all one. This is it, right here. This is what it's really like. Even though he knew that they weren't gonna all get it.
Right. So even if you're the whore and the sterile woman with many children and the holy woman and all those, even if you see yourself as any or all of those things, you're still one with that consciousness.
So driving in tonight on NPR, they were interviewing, they were talking about how many Muslims are speaking out about ISIS and such, mm-hmm. and professors and all these different, whether they're actually leaders of mosques or professors in Islam, and then just people in general. And they're saying some of them are actually now saying that ISIS is an apostate, and in Islam, that means that everybody's called to kill them, because the whole point of, that's just that. So this guy was saying Muslims need to come up and they need to talk to their mullahs and such and find out, so how do we do this? How do we attack on various levels? How do we save our next generation? How do we teach that what they're teaching isn't right? And how do we also literally, he was saying, we literally need to go to war with them. And then you have people that are cautious about that, because they say as soon as we say that, we become what ISIS is, because ISIS is now claiming that they're the only true way and everybody else is apostate. And so is it ISIS versus the other, or is it tolerance versus demonstration of love versus, and that's what we get caught in. That's what we get caught in.
The war isn't going to do it. It's the Muslim people themselves who have to turn it.
Right. It has to be evolved.
It's like the paradox you and I talk about a lot when we're talking about politics and society. Is at what point does tolerance become unable to tolerate intolerance?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's huge. I mean, they interviewed on MSNBC tonight, Chris.
Matthews.
No. The other one. Well, no.
Chris Hayes
was interviewing a woman who worked for the magazine that had been bombed before.
And Charlie Hebdo.
She was saying that if this continues, what she saw is the role for, she said, hopefully it's everybody, but she's saying it's center left people, is we have to remember to keep standing for what it is we believe in, because, which is love and overcoming and such, because otherwise in a decade Europe will be a fascist state, mm-hmm. because fear will do that faster than anything else, and it's already, well, I know, and it's already happening, yeah, here and such, and
well, then they'll finally catch up with us.
Yeah. So that's the challenge we all have right now. We're not just talking about this philosophically anymore. This is
So now we'll move on to the Gospel of John.
I went one other,
which
question.
Will seem a lot easier to handle now than it ever was before.
One other interesting thing about thunder, if you just a little reference, I don't know that it has anything to do with this, but John and blanking on which one was his brother, is it Andrew? Mm-hmm. Were called the Sons of Thunder, which also sort of makes you think if this is connected to John. So just a little
good point.
Side.
So, basic background on the book of John, pretty well agreed that it was written somewhere around 90 CE. It was written or edited in excellent Greek by someone who was obviously well educated. I will utter my usual caveats about authorship. We don't know. It doesn't matter.
Probably not the disciples stuck on the island of Greece.
It's always viewed as the outsider gospel, because its content, its approach, its attitude, everything is really radically different from the other three. Some scholars have sort of expressed surprise that it made it into the canon, because it was so completely different than the other gospel accounts. But it was written at a time when these other gospel accounts that were circulating were either all sayings gospels, or they were all story gospels, or life gospels, biographical gospels. And nobody was talking about Christology. That hadn't come up yet. And so whoever was the originators of the content of John must have decided that it was time to have a document that would tell people who Jesus really was. All these stories about his life and events that took place and signs or miracles that he carried out and so forth was all well and good, but it wasn't getting anybody any closer to understanding who Jesus really was. So that seems to be the intent and purpose of John.
Where were these things actually found, the writings?
No, these weren't found. They were never lost.
Well, John, the book of John that he's talking about is one of the original, canonical.
They were never found. They didn't get found because they were lost. They've just been there from the time they were written.
They never had to rediscover them. They've just been passed down.
I mean, where did our historians find them?
They were just in churches.
In churches and
synagogues and in monasteries and so forth.
In writing?
Yeah, they were being used in writing. They were being used in teaching and lessons.
Well, for Christianity,
until
it was the Romans and Greeks, the various church heads had copies, and they had scribes, so
right.
they continued to copy them, and so there was never for the canonical.
Lots of them, yeah.
For all of the New Testament that was adopted, they had copies, and once they were adopted, then they were copied and copied and copied and copied
right.
because they were the official canon. So there was never a break in them. The ones that we've discovered are the ones that weren't accepted into the canon, who got lost, some didn't. Some of those stuck around too, like the odes.
Yes. John falls into a very nice overall structure. There's a prologue, or what you might think of as an opening poem, that covers in chapter 1, verses 1 through 18.
That you're all very familiar with.
Yeah, that's the in the beginning was the word stuff. And then beginning in chapter 1:19 and going until the end of chapter 12 is a collection of things that are referred to in biblical circles as the book of signs. And then from chapter 13 to the end of chapter 20 is a collection of, these are the stories about Jesus' late ministry and crucifixion, resurrection, called the book of glory. At least that's just a term that we use among people who are studying this stuff. And then chapter 21 is an epilogue or an appendix. Easily the most organized and tightly structured of the four canonical gospels. The book of signs, which is the bulk of the book, a little over half the total content, is in turn structured around seven paired units, and this is the stuff that really gets where we get most of our information. Each of these units begins with a sign, which a lot of evangelicals call miracles, but the word used in the gospel is a Greek word that clearly means sign. And then each sign then gets followed by a lengthy discussion or discourse by Jesus explaining the significance and or meaning of the sign. Unlike the parables and the shorter stories in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where there either is no explanation or the explanation is clear from the context of what Jesus was saying before the parable was delivered, what the meaning was, you don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about it. In John, we have this fairly lengthy discourse after each of these seven signs that John selects, and he selects them apparently because they are good teaching moments. And here's this discourse from Jesus about each one of them. Now, did Jesus actually sit down and explain each of these things after he did them? Probably not. Probably over time he explained these things to his disciples and his apostles, and they gathered the stuff together, and then he compiled them in a nice, organized way. Here, that's not how life works, you know. He doesn't raise a guy from the dead and say, "Let me tell you why I did that." Things just don't work that way. Almost all of these speeches in the that are following these signs use the same formula that goes back very anciently. It goes back to Mesopotamia and very early Kuru Mazda and a bunch of really early gods. The ancient formula for a divine figure revealing its true identity, they always start with I am. That goes back way, way before Hebrew history, way before the Mount Sinai experience, way before any of that, centuries before that. And, of course, I wrote a book on the power of I am, so that's, I'm glad to see that there because it's good advertising. You know? Shameless plug. I get to do those once in a while. I thought it'd be interesting to sort of briefly compare some of the I am statements with those in Thunder Perfect Mind. As I said then, very few of the I am statements in that book are paralleling to those in John. But there are a lot of that appear in John that don't appear at least clearly in Thunder. And they, what they tend to be is really simple comparisons as opposed to these elaborate poetic observations that are contained in the Thunder Perfect Mind. There are things like the way, the light, the truth, the bread of life. So I am statements are usually very short and pungent and fairly clear in terms of they're using analogies from daily life. They're not difficult to ferret out what the meanings are. We have in the and this is how John goes about trying to explain Christology, that is the nature of Jesus. Now, so Thunder Perfect Mind appears to be, if we can take it at face value, Jesus talking about his nature in all of these paradoxical ways, paradoxical because words aren't adequate. And so he's trying to do the other things we just talked about. In John, it's much more straightforward, much clearer. The Christology is simpler, but it's a very interesting and intricate Christology. We don't have time to go into it tonight, but it really is. Maybe one of these times we'll have a class on John. I mentioned this before, but I just want to make sure in passing I don't overlook it. Every time in the Gospel of John where you say, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, the light, the is extraneous. It's not in the original. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, but I don't want to go into this. There's a huge amount of grammatical technicality behind that it would take me an hour to explain. So, but it does. And so so the interpretation or the recorrecting translation that I'm suggesting is I am way, I am light, I am truth, talking about the essence of Jesus as opposed to the meaning I am the only or the sole way. That's something really, that's something I believe that I believe my interpretation of that is correct. And a number of scholars have agreed with that, but there are still people in the evangelical community who say the fact that it says the way means that's the only way. So although it's slightly inaccurate, only because it's very technical, to say there was no definite article in the Aramaic language. The fact is there was no definite article in the Aramaic language that was used as we use definite articles in our language. So,
do they use definite articles at all?
Yeah, they use a definite article, but it isn't called a definite article. It isn't described as one. It isn't used that linguistically until many centuries later. And I think it was probably reverse adapted so that the Bible would make sense to some people then. But that's another issue. I'm not a scholar of Aramaic.
Well, it makes it so you can quote follow it.
Right. Exactly.
As opposed to necessarily be.
So, and I notice also that in John, these I am sayings always take place in the context of a sign story. Whereas in Thunder, they are the message. And then the other thing that I want to point out about John, we can, as I said, do weeks and weeks on John, so I'm just trying to focus on things that are connected to their purpose in this book. The other thing I want to talk about the Gospel of John is the incredibly interesting role of femininity in John's Gospel. The feminine side comes through in a couple of different ways. One is in parallel passages. So Vicki sort of mentioned earlier that Jesus is identified with wisdom at a number of different places in the Gospel, and wisdom is always feminine. In every ancient language, whatever it was, in Greek it's Sophia, in Coptic it's T-S-O-P-H-I, Sophia. In Hebrew and Aramaic it comes out Chachma. Those are always feminine nouns. What is the word for wisdom in Spanish?
Sabiduría.
Is it a feminine noun?
Yes.
Yeah. And French, what's the word? It's sagesse. Sagesse. La sagesse. S-A-G-E-S-S-E.
Okay.
So that's French. So that's also feminine. So.
Excuse me.
I don't know how many other languages might be represented, but every place I look to find out, that it seems that every language that I know about or I could find out about, the word for wisdom is always feminine. Except in English, of course, where we don't differentiate gender.
Yeah, and I don't know if that really means anything either, because like a table is feminine and a floor is.
I don't know if it means anything either, except that if it's true across all these languages, including anciently, I think Sophia was a character.
He came in here.
Sophia was a person. And came out of that, and then probably the other languages adopted the idea of femininity, you know.
Who turned on to begin with?
One me.
Well, we can't make it go off, but
yeah.
Bacon, can you go turn
it? Well, it was going, but all the heat was going upstairs. So I just changed the vent so it would come here, and now it'll
That's
probably
too hot here.
Go on for hours because the thermostat's up
it
there.
Stick your fork in me.
I've never heard that before.
So there are a lot of ways that the Gospel of John identifies Jesus with wisdom. And so I'm going to take a little side trip with you here. It won't take me long, but I need to do it because of some of the references I want to make. So I'll give you some parallel passages from John and other scriptures to talk about how this connection to wisdom shows up. To do that, I have to venture into an area we have never been in before, which is the area of what are called deuterocanonical books.
Does that mean
deuterocanonical books? Deutero means second. Deuterocanonical books are the books that exist in the Catholic Bible between the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. There are between 14 and 22 books, depending on whose compilation you read, that the Catholic Church accepts as Scripture.
Don't change it.
The Protestant Church has never accepted. So their nature, their rule, their role, their importance, we don't know. Protestantism just doesn't accept them at all. Catholicism accepts them and considers them part of literature, but they are part of Old Testament wisdom. They're not New Testament. They're all related to Hebrew history and Hebrew teachings and philosophy and so forth. And one of those books is called The Wisdom of Solomon. And that's one of the reasons I had to get this in, because we're going to talk a little bit about what's in there. Until 1517, when the Reformation began, the Protestant Reformation began, when Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the church at Wittenberg, there was no doubt anywhere in Christianity that these books were part of canon. There was never debate about it. They were all part of it. They were part of canon. But in 1517, Luther, when he nailed those 95 theses on the wall, some of those theses related to what's a legitimate book of the Bible and what isn't. And he took all of these books out, which were called apocryphal books. And he also took out Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelation. So his version of the New Testament canon was pretty different from what we even ended up with today. When he did that, then the other reformers came along behind him. They put Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelation back, but they left the Apocrypha out, which is why it's almost an accident of clerical history that they're not part of the Bible that we use all the time in our own worship services and so forth.
I think that's even been expanded again.
I think you're right.
Protestant churches use the.
That's why I like this Bible, the Oxford annotated.
Yeah.
This is the New Revised Standard Version, but it has the Apocrypha in it.
Now that's what they say. They say with Apocrypha.
With Apocrypha,
right.
Yeah, right.
It's in the middle.
It's in the middle between the Old and New Testament.
And it's the Intertestament. That's where you.
Right.
It's where you learn about how Hanukkah came about and all. It's
the
history.
The Maccabean revolt.
Yeah. That
I don't know. My whole life, I have always dismissed it. I've never read it. I didn't think anything about it. And when I started preparing this lesson on John and this subject came up, I started looking into it, and I thought, I've been a boob. Well, I'm following other people's ideas about what's in here, so I'm going to go spend some time working on learning that stuff and figuring it out.
It's in the Catholic Bible and now in any Bible, because this isn't a Catholic Bible, it's a Protestant, but it includes Apocrypha. You can get
well, the Catholics would call this a Catholic Bible now because it's got the Apocrypha in it, right?
Well,
it,
no, because it's in a different order. And
oh,
they,
right,
make,
yeah,
they
yeah.
have their books
have
different,
their own, yeah.
and they don't have one and two. They make
yeah,
them, you know,
yeah.
so it's not the Catholic Bible. It's a Protestant Bible, but with the Apocrypha.
Our old family Bible has it in it.
Yeah?
It's a Christian Bible. It's not a Catholic Bible.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
I believe the family was primarily Methodist at
mm-hmm.
time.
Well, that could be the Episcopals
yeah.
put
yeah.
it back in. The Episcopals would have put it back in because they were yeah. actually more Catholic, so they maybe did it. And Methodist came out of the Episcopals. So,
yeah.
so just now that you understand that some of these quotations, and by the way, the quotation on Sunday that Vicki included in the Christian scriptures.
Yeah, what was that?
That
Sirach.
Was the book. That's the book of Sirach,
which
is one
is
of these
part
books.
Of the Apocrypha.
Oh,
one of these apocryphal books.
She's made something.
So here's what. what I will not be at all surprised to see in coming months is that as we do these three scriptures on Sunday, more and more apocryphal and new and stuff from a new Testament starts
yes,
creeping
yeah.
in as Christian
yep.
literature because it's so apropos and it's so much clearer than some of the stuff we have other places. So. So here's a couple of parallel examples. I'm going to try to wrap this up fast. John 1:1 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That's what we're familiar with. From the wisdom of Solomon, 9:9, "With you, God is wisdom, who knows your works and was present when you made the world." So, wisdom of Solomon goes back a number of centuries. So it's Hebrew scripture. I'm not trying to date it right now, but it goes back a while. John 1:4, "In the Word was life, and the life was the light of men." And Proverbs 8:35, "For whoso findeth me findeth life and shall obtain favor of the Lord."
Proverbs what?
Proverbs 8:35. I should point out there as I'm quoting John 1:4 that I'm not following the evangelical translation that substitutes. Where it says, where I read in the Word, it says in Him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not appropriate for a male pronoun to be used anywhere in that whole prologue. That's always about logos, which is the Word. It's not a person. It's not a being. It's not a man. It doesn't mean gender. So I always call it the Word or it. John 1:11, "The Word came unto its own, and its own received them not." Received it not. And First Enoch, which is one of these apocryphal books, says, "Wisdom went forth to make her dwelling among the children of men and found no dwelling place." So there are all these parallels between Jesus and there are dozens of these, between Jesus and wisdom and in terms of divine feminine that's really, it's unique to John in terms of the gospel accounts that we have. And it's a very interesting sort of rich level of discourse that brings a whole new set of meanings to Jesus' life when we look at it in the 21st century. And then the only other point I want to make is that the women in John are way more visible and vocal than they are in the Synoptic Gospels. And a lot, yeah, they're named, which is also the case. There are some examples. Jesus' mother argues with him at the wedding. He says, "Why would I'm not? This is not my job." And she said, "Go do it." The Canaanite woman who meets Jesus at the well has maybe the longest unbroken dialogue with him of any character in any of the Gospels. The famous story of Mary and Martha, right? They're debating with him, they're pleading with him, they're asking to be taught by him and so forth. The post-resurrection encounter with Mary Magdalene outside the tomb. And although there are more women in Luke's gospel, as it turns out by count, there are several in John that appear nowhere else, and those in John tend to be deeper, more engaged, more visible, more vocal. So all in all, John comes up on the feminine side of the ledger in comparison to Thunder Perfect Mind very favorably, which I thought was pretty interesting. So.
The other interesting thing about John, because it's so metaphysical, it's the favorite scripture of evangelicals and it's favorite scripture
yeah.
of unity.
I skipped over that. But yeah,
so
you're right.
Because you can interpret it, because it's metaphysically written, it's symbolically written, you can interpret it either way you want. So it's interesting that you'll find those quotes often in evangelicals, and then unity uses them with a different, obviously different interpretation.
Even though if you look at the speeches I mentioned in that portion of the Gospel of John, the Book of Signs, those explanations don't need to be interpreted very metaphysically to get the message. So this is a case where we look at the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we do a metaphysical interpretation that differs from evangelicals. When we come to John, we say, look, you don't have to look too deep here. This is pretty clear stuff. And they go, no, you got to get metaphysical about this.
Right. Where we take it more literally, yeah, and they have to interpret it to fit it back into into their other beliefs. Yeah. So the next one we're looking at in this group is which we've talked about before, is the Gospel of Mary, which is actually the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. It was discovered with the... another copy was discovered with Nag Hammadi. And, in fact, it's been discovered now in three different places, which makes them...
Different portions of it.
Right. They didn't fill in too much. One was more complete, and the other were two partials, but they didn't fill in the missing parts.
They were mostly parts that we already had.
But what they're saying is for that many, to find that many references meant that it was a pretty common... That many years later, to find more than one means that it was had to have been fairly commonly used. They believe it's a 5th century. There was a 5th century manuscript, was the earliest one that we know of. That doesn't mean that's when it was written. That's like the first one that they became aware of. There's still no complete copy, and it's interesting because the pieces that are missing... You could go with the story of it was one of those that was found and they tore out pages to burn. But interestingly, the pages that are torn out are very specific teachings that also could have been torn out because they just didn't want those teachings.
They were heretical.
Yeah. So we only have about half of it, of the gospel. It's not very long. There's only 8 pages that we have, and they think... Pardon?
He's looking at you guys like.
No, I understand.
But they do give a really interesting glimpse. For example, they present a radical interpretation of Jesus' teachings as a path to inner spiritual knowledge. And this is one like Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Thomas, Thunder, the Odes. All of them are much more aligned with Unity's understanding, which is interesting because Fillmore and New Thought came up with those understandings before any of these scriptures were at least before they were public, because they took them about 40 years to interpret them for the public to actually be able to read them. With the whole idea is that inner spiritual knowledge is about finding our true human identity. You see that as kind of a common theme, that it isn't about that we're horrible, terrible sinners, but that to be human is that we've forgotten who we are, which we talk about a lot. It rejects the suffering and death of Jesus as the path to eternal life. It exposes the erroneous view that Mary of Magdala was a prostitute for what it, you know, that was just created by a pope at some point, that he just read about these different women and decided that he was going to conflate them, and once a pope says it, then...
He's infallible.
It presents the most straightforward and convincing argument in any early Christian writing for the legitimacy of women's leadership, because obviously she's presented as sort of the apostle to the apostles. It offers a sharp critique of illegitimate power and a utopian vision of spiritual perfection. It challenges our rather romantic views about the harmony and unanimity of the first Christians. And it asks us to rethink the basis for church authority. And it's all written in the name of Mary Magdalene. It's a fairly simple. Again, the first 6 pages were lost. So it opens in the middle of a scene that's portraying a discussion between resurrected Jesus and his disciples. And he's answering their questions about the end of the material world and the nature of sin. They're asking him questions about this. And he's teaching them that at present all things, whether material or spiritual, are interwoven with each other. But in the end, they will not be so. Each, as he says, each nature will return to its own root, its own original state and destiny. The nature of sin, again, we got to remember sin is error, right? It's confusion. The nature of sin is that it's tied to the nature of life in this mixed up world. That's what gets us confused. People sin because they don't recognize their own spiritual nature, and instead we get caught up with and addicted to the lower nature that deceives us and leads us into disease and death. You know, so we get all caught up in the material world.
In fact, the first time he's asked about sin, he says there is no sin.
Right.
Which we've been telling people for years.
I know. It's interesting because their orientation, I was reading a thing that said, and shocking to most people is that she would say that he said there's no sin. I said, shocking to who?
Most people.
Yes. So salvation is achieved by discovering within oneself the true spiritual nature of humanity and overcoming the deceptive entrapments of bodily passions and the world, which, again, is pretty much what... Now, those get interpreted oftentimes as just sexuality and that sort of thing, but it's really about just how we get hooked into our sense consciousness as opposed to what we teach every Sunday, you know, that we need to go within and who's in the driver's seat. Are you allowing sense consciousness to be in the driver's seat or our inner knowing? And we don't demonize sense consciousness. It just has to follow as opposed to be in charge. The other thing that it's very much about is that this isn't talking about when you die. This is talking about a way of living now. So to discover this knowledge is to find peace and salvation, if you will, today in how we live right now. After that, he departs. And interestingly, the disciples, as they put it, do not go out joyfully to preach the gospel. Instead, controversy erupts, and all the disciples except Mary have clearly failed to comprehend what he was talking about. So rather than seeking, he tells them all, you know, you need to be about seeking the peace within and going out and sharing the good news. Well, instead, they sort of all start talking to each other, and what does he mean? And, you know, we could get beat up if we go out and say these things, and it's going to be scary. And so Mary steps up and begins to comfort them, and then Peter asks her to tell them what, clearly she's close to the Lord, and if he taught her anything that he hadn't said to any of them, and would she share that with them? And so she describes the a variety of things about how to that she's had visions of him, and she asked Jesus, "Well, when I have a vision of you, who's having that vision? How do visions come about?" And basically, what Jesus tells her is, "It isn't like your soul visioning me or whatever. It's basically we're meeting. These aren't the words they use, but it's what it we're meeting in divine mind. We're meeting in the original state that we share. So it isn't some part of you down here reaching some part of me up there. It's the part that we both still connect.
The one consciousness.
Yeah. So, and then
there goes oneness again.
Right.
That's it.
And then she talks about how the soul rises to its final rest, and again then we lose a chunk of that description, and it starts in the middle of chapter 8, and she's actually saying to him, Gospel of Mary's not very long either, so she actually describes this, it just breaks into the middle, that the soul is saying to desire, talking to desire, and then it talks to these various stages, these various aspects that she describes as the seven powers of wrath. So there's seven powers of wrath that the soul has to move through. And they're darkness, desire, ignorance, death, the excitement of death, they called it, which I thought was interesting, the kingdom of flesh, foolish wisdom of the flesh, and wrathful wisdom or anger. So think about each of those, of how that could entrap a soul to not be able to rise. So basically, as I was reading those, that's what we talk about. All of those are ego factors, and how do we move beyond the ego for our soul to continue to ascend into being aware and living from our divine essence? So darkness is, for me, is fear and ignorance. So our fear gets in the way, right? And we don't move forward. Desires. Well, the Buddha's, you know, all the Buddhist teachings are about how our desires can get in the way. Now, what they teach is that all of these things can be good as well, you know, but they can get in the way or they can be a positive. So how, same way Dan was asking, how does desire work in our favor?
When we desire the divine,
Right.
True.
Right. And then, so desire is actually that motivating force that keeps us going. So it's what we desire that gets in that, either it helps us or it doesn't help us. If we're desiring the material world, you know, then it can get us into trouble. But if we are desiring our higher self, then it's actually a positive. Ignorance. Is there a way that ignorance could be a positive?
Innocence.
Yeah. Innocence and openness, right? Because think of the opposite of ignorance. If you go to the negative, we can be, it's exactly what we talk about, why they write in these confusing things, because we think we've got it all figured out. So ignorance is an openness and a willingness to receive a new word, to have ears to hear.
And ignorance is a motivator for the desire to learn.
To learn, right. Death or they called it the excitement of death. What do you think that?
Of the old of the ignorance?
Could be that. I think actually, for me, I think they were actually talking about that death becomes this very, either very scary thing that we do everything to avoid death, or it becomes a very ritualistic, you know, and we create trying to speak to the other side. And, I mean, we can get all caught up in that and not realize it's just a doorway.
Yeah, one place it uses the word eagerness for death.
Right.
So it's like you reach a point in your life where things are, you're in despair. And you
think
say,
it's
you
an
know,
escape.
Yeah, I wish I could die.
Okay.
Which also I think would be addressing that when people started saying, so if you figure she's writing sort of later, probably they're saying second century, most likely it was written, is everything's become about heaven, not
right,
about
that's
this
a good point
life.
Too. Yeah, right.
And so if we're eager to die because we think that's where we're going to end up in heaven and be with God, and she's saying no, but so that can get
and
in the way.
Martyrdom
if you make
became
it all,
really important.
Yeah, martyrdom, you make it all about the afterlife and not about this life.
It's like the radical jihadists, right, who
right.
die because they think they're immediately transcended into heaven.
Yeah,
it's
but
the best thing that could happen
to them.
Don't need a body.
What do you do with the virgins?
Presumably, the virgins are also spirit worlds. I don't know. I haven't looked that up.
I don't
yet.
Think they think it through,
no,
frankly.
They
yeah.
not.
They're not getting paid to think.
No.
Especially if they're that young.
Desperation, I know.
Virgins.
Wow.
Yeah, I get a bunch of 20-year-old men promise them virgins.
See what happens. What could possibly
and the alternative, is not very good. This world isn't looking real good in that round. Yeah,
well, what could
purpose.
Possibly go wrong?
Yeah. So anyway, then she finishes her account. So she's just teaching them about. So this is what Jesus had taught her about the soul making its way through these different layers. You could also compare them to the some of the other mystical things about this. Paul's things about
right.
going through the layers of heaven and such, which is each one is dealing with another layer of our ego, basically, and overcoming it. So as she finishes her account, two of the disciples, Andrew and Peter, quite unexpectedly challenge her. Andrew objects that her teaching is strange, and he refuses to believe that it came from the Savior, like saying there's no sin. Peter goes further, denying that Jesus would have ever said these things to a woman, not to the rest of them, of course. And or that he would have preferred her to them. I mean, on the one hand, he knew that. If you think about it, he asked her to say it.
That's right.
And yet, on the other hand, then when she actually did have really deep wisdom, then he didn't quite know what to do with that. It said, apparently, when he had asked her to speak, Peter had not expected such elevated teachings. And now he questioned her character, implying that she's lied about having received these special teachings in order to increase her stature. So taken aback, now this is the downside. Taken aback, Mary begins to cry. And she's silenced, basically, because she begins to cry and Levi comes to her rescue and she isn't the one to defend herself. That Levi comes to her rescue and basically points out to Peter that he's a notorious hothead and that he ought to chill. And that he's treating Mary as though she were the enemy, and that's exactly what Jesus had warned them against, that they were going to start, that they were not supposed to start fighting amongst one another,
themselves.
That they were supposed to remember the truth. They weren't supposed to create anything new but go out and teach what he had taught them. And the story ends
there. There's a war for you or whatever he was talking about.
Right, but clearly the controversy is far from resolved because you can imagine, we have this image of that they were all in the upper room and the Holy Spirit came and they all went out in, you know, in mass two by two to preach these.
Each with a piece of the elephant.
Yes, each with a piece of the elephant.
But it's interesting, too, how Jesus apparently chose to tell Mary all these special things, but not the whole.
Well, or...
Not them.
Yeah, well... I mean, if you look at even in the normal canonical Gospels, he would teach them and they wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. Over and over and over and over again, it says. He takes them aside and he teaches them, and then a minute later, asks some dumb question, or Peter says, you know, he teaches them this whole esoteric thing, and they say, Yeah, but can I sit at the right hand of the, you know, and he's going, And what comes out is that Mary understands, and so she has dialogues with him that the other disciples don't. And so, you know, depending upon the school, it can expand to, there are those that see her as the feminine, that the cultural context wouldn't allow her to be the teacher was, but in fact that they were equal teachers.
Did they educate women in those days?
Not broadly, though.
Right. Though.
So how is it that she was so
though
wise
Jews,
or educated or
Jews did, I think Jews tended to, you know, it wasn't
well,
like.
Jewish culture at that time treated women way better than
right.
any other culture in that.
And there would be, and they would not have told them they couldn't learn. Now, whether or not they had to be from a home or something where there would be time, but it certainly wasn't like what we see in the Islamic.
In the Quran, they do talk about her education. The Quran
right.
chronicles that portion of her education.
Right.
You're right.
And she's an independent woman, so very likely she is literate.
Parallel passages.
And such, but it would take more than, I mean, it's more than being literate, too, because they don't even know that Jesus was literate.
We get the impression that Mary was available, made herself available to listen.
Yep.
Over and over again, her posture at his feet and with her hair. And
that's,
these, well, I
you're
don't
confusing
know if
that's
the same
Mary's,
Mary,
right.
at any rate, her being available to listen.
Mary Magdalene is the one person who's named by name in the most times, who's the first one there. Over
obviously
and over and over again. So obviously, not necessarily, because they may, I mean, there's a whole thing about whether they were married or not, but the fact is, if they could have been spiritual leaders, that there may not have been any sexuality involved in it. So it may not have been about being married. But that wouldn't take them away from being, in fact, to not be married would have made her more his equal than if she was married to him, which would have put her in a whole different role. Because that's the argument they use that Paul many times when he encouraged women to not be married, to not marry but to live for the church and such, and people thought it was prudishness, when in fact it meant that they were no longer, if they did that, their fathers didn't control them and they didn't have a husband that controlled them. They actually were freer and had more autonomy if they weren't married than if they were. So again, we know that this gospel was written before the canonical gospels. So it was one of the ones. So it had to be before 3rd century when the canonical gospel. I guess that's fourth century when mm-hmm. the canon was formed. But so and because they found these three different and they were in two different languages and such, it was probably fairly widespread. We tend to think that there was sort of this monolithic, and again, that didn't happen until the politics of Constantine. Prior to Constantine, you've got different groups, almost much more like today, where you got all these different groups, though they didn't call themselves. They're all Christians, but they didn't talk to each other, and they didn't have any authority that was saying, well, it had to be this way versus that way, or claiming one way was right. They would just shared things, and groups would go the way whatever that group decided to go and whichever readings they had available to them and however they were inspired. So it was a much more mystical tradition and following. And there were probably a number of women, even Paul talked about women that were available. One scholar suggests that we've probably lost 85% of Christian literature from the first 2 centuries that we will never have. 85% of the writings and letters and
think we're gonna find them
and prayers, and they don't
That's
think we'll
thinking.
Find them. Yeah, because
I think he gave up too fast.
The library was burned in Alexandria too.
Well, and that, and again, you got to recall that these wouldn't survive if they weren't being copied.
Yeah, I've heard that, huh?
But the when was the Vatican built? You know, so we're talking the papyrus things, some of them that we have found that survived because they happened to be wrapped in a bowl and sealed and that sort of thing. But if you didn't have officials making copies, which is how the canonical survived, it's just very difficult to. So anyway, that's their suggestion. There was no, the other thing that they talked about is we tend to think of the Nicene Creed and such as our foundation, when in fact it was the result. It came after, not before. There was no Nicene Creed. There was no Apostles' Creed and such. All that came in the 4th century. So up until then, it was just the whole collective process and probably a lot of strife and struggle between the different apostles, just like you see there. And there's other Nag Hammadi Gospels like Andrew, is it Andrew? No, Philip, and such that also indicate that there was quite a bit of fighting. And in the traditional Bible, we know that, you know, Paul was fighting with James and Peter and such as to whether or not the people that Paul was bringing in had to be circumcised, whether or not they had to eat Jewish foods and such. So there was a lot of disagreement going on in the beginning times. Which brings us back to why it's so important that we have the mystical link. One of the things that you'll find in Unity books all the time is you can read all this stuff and then you need to go within and listen, because the Christ Spirit, that awareness within you will reveal the truth that then you can bring to the books rather than the books forming the box that you have to live in. The last one we'll do really fast here.
Or you want to hold it?
You want to hold it till next
week? I don't
week?
Know. Next week
we don't have
class.
Next week. We have
the following week. We have eight books we're doing.
We're not going
to. So we're not going to do the same book by book kind of stuff at that point. We're doing.
Well, can we keep
different.
Going?
Well, let me.
It's okay
I'll
me
do
for
a little bit,
and
we can
want.
Go a little bit longer. This one is called The Gospel of Truth. It's the last book.
Brilliant.
In this, it's interesting if you Google
yes.
that. There's very little on commentary on this actual gospel of truth, but there's a whole bunch about which gospel tells the truth, what's
yeah,
the truth in the gospel, and such. It's considered one of the Gnostic texts that was found at Nag Hammadi. It exists in two Coptic translations, one surviving almost in full and one in fragments, and there's significant differences between the two in this term. They believe that it was likely written in Greek between 140 and 180 by do you know how you say his name? Valentinian Gnostic.
Yes, right.
Though there are many who think that it was actually written by, what's his name? Valentine?
Valentius.
Actually, it was written by him, and he evidently was the leader of a Gnostic movement. This is where...
He was the leader of a group that was accused of Gnosticism.
Okay. Which is what would clarify this, yes, because again, a lot of the Gnostic Nag Hammadi, the Coptic Gospels of Thomas, Philip, and Truth, are not Gnostic. That's what we've been talking about now. We've labeled them the Gnostic Gospels and in the early writings and such, and now they're really starting to distinguish about what Gnosticism actually taught.
Right.
And while they're not Gnostic.
Well, that's remember the
depending
first
depending upon how you define Gnosticism.
Remember the first week I talked about.
Yeah.
Gnosticism isn't. We've treated Gnosticism as if it were a school
right.
of thought, a big unified. It's not.
It's not right.
Gnosticism
Thomas
is
Philip
better described as kind of a loose collection of maybe some ideas. Like she was talking about, well, the path to knowledge is the pathway to salvation and so forth. But there's no school called Gnosticism. That was made up by the second century Christian fathers who wanted to control the mainstream.
Who wanted to be able to label something heretic.
Yep.
And so if it was about knowledge rather than needing to come to the priest, you know, and such. They, and what they're saying is the actual Gnostic, one of the principles is whether or not you that they believe in actual material world is part of where they're starting to look at the differences between them. This writing is thought to cite or allude to New Testament Gospels of Matthew and John, as well as 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Hebrew, 1st John, and the book of Revelation. So you see, it was a writing that came after a lot of those books were around, and they had access, the writer had access, and it was also influenced by Thomas at one point. And that's, they know that because the lines written in it are actual, the same lines that appear in those various books. The opening paragraphs of the Gospel of Truth describe the primordial fall and the origin of the material universe in a pretty interesting way. In fact, I'll just read you the first. The good news of truth is joy for those who have received grace from the Father of the truth, that they might know him through the power of the word, which has come from the fullness and is in the thought and mind of the Father. They speak about this one as Savior, the name given to the work he is to do to redeem those who had not known the Father. And the name Good News is the revelation of hope, for this is the discovery of those who seek him. So the whole idea, it's a very positive and optimistic perspective. And it explains the transgression. They called it transgression and forgetfulness. So it basically is exactly, if we wrote a beginning story, it would be like, so everybody came from God, but they forgot that they came from God. And then they started searching for something, and in their searching, they got confused and troubled and ignorant, and then that became its own power. And it started, became like a fog, or like falling asleep and having bad dreams. I mean, it uses all of those kinds of images. And then when Jesus comes, he comes to awaken them back into knowledge of God and awareness. So it's sort of this, the gospel is all about that story. So it describes a theory of the rise of error, and it almost personifies error. And some of
it does, in fact, it characterizes transgression as a female persona.
Persona, and so some say that it could refer to Valentinian's idea of the devil or mm-hmm. Diabolos or world ruler. But they say even more likely, he also uses this this concept of lack or deficiency. So error represents lack and deficiency. The term error and lack are used interchangeably in the gospel. And error, like lack, is closely identified with matter and the physical body. And error, like lack, is destroyed by the advent of truth and knowledge. So as you would read through this, it's sort of this battle between this ignorance, error, confusion, and knowledge, that we awaken into knowledge. It arises because the aeons didn't know who the Father was, and so they accepted error. It's sort of like our thing, that we get caught up that we think we're actually physical beings, and so we get all caught up in the physical realm. I mean, it's very similar to that until we get awakened to that there's another aspect to who we are. The material realm is in some manner always associated with error. And I didn't have a chance to read this deep enough to know. I didn't get that it makes it like evil, but it's clearly the distraction that we talk about. And when we're lost in it, that's we forget who we are. So the unknowability of the Father, because the Father is unknowable. I love that the words that they give the Father, the name of God, too. All things were within him, the uncontainable, incomprehensible one who surpasses all thought. That's the name of God. And periodically they go back to the uncontainable, incomprehensible one. That is God. So it's hard to know that God. So Jesus becomes like the go-between, so that people have an opportunity to connect and relate to, which, I mean, that's the story we tell too, right? So why God incarnates? Well, just one that looks like us and talks like us and such, and becomes a doorway to knowing the unknowable. So that's an interesting paradox. But isn't that what we talk about? To know God is to know the unknowable. So it isn't a knowledge, human knowledge thing. It becomes an experience. To know is more the
experiential,
the biblical, as we talk about it, biblical knowing, though not meaning sex. But so when we're not in knowing, it's like falling asleep and being in the midst of nightmares. So that's sort of we're going over time. So Jesus is sent to remove the ignorance, and he's given many dimensions. He's seen as a teacher of parables. He's described as the Word. He's described as the Mother. And he's described as a cosmic presence, as the one whose teachings correct the transgression, the Antichrist, basically, I guess you would call it, that makes all humanity ignorant. And so error grows angry at this and nails Jesus to a tree. But even in that, he becomes, by being nailed to the tree, he becomes the fruit of the Father's knowledge. And so everyone who eats of the fruit becomes aware of the Father's knowledge. So each time error tries to overcome him, it's like he becomes the expression. Then there's a lot of phrases that, this is another one that if you read, you kind of shake your head and go, okay, let me do that again. But
it's really brilliant.
But it is. There's all kinds of lines about that. So the people are in, it's very similar to Jesus said, if you're in me, I'm in the Father, so you're in the Father. And he does that poetically in a number of different ways. And again, it's not about a realm after life. It's about living here now. That God, which became a way for those who strayed, and knowledge for those who were ignorant, and discovery for those who were searching, and strength for those who were shaken, and purity for those who were defiled. The results are that the Father is within them and they are in the Father. They are full and undivided from one who is truly good. They need nothing at all, but they are at rest, fresh in spirit, and will listen to their root. So that's what happens when they connect with it's interesting, they go back to connecting with their root, which is what Mary says in her gospel, is that everything will go back to its root. It will go back to its essence. And what we're saying is we go back to the oneness, that we're of God, and we'll go back to that essence of God. And it won't matter what this physical world is, because that's not our true essence.
I find totally amazing how intuitive these guys are, these writers are, how many centuries ago?
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, they talk about it, in some ways it was easier for them to do that then, because they had less actual attachment to the material. No, because now with science and all of that, we're actually more engaged and entwined in the material world than they were. They were much more looking for answers. They didn't have material answers, so they were much more open to looking for esoteric answers. Yes, another really good quote, though. So when one achieves rest through gnosis, the awakened can become engaged and hear the gospel's mandate, the good news, which is, speak of the day from above, which has no night, and of the perfect light that does not set. Say then from the heart that you are the perfect day, and within you dwells the light that will never end. Speak of the truth with those who seek it, and of knowledge with those who have sinned through their transgressions. Strengthen the feet of those who stumble, and stretch your hands to those who are weak. Feed those who are hungry, and give rest to the weary. So once you awaken, then your call is to awaken others and be there. So a lot of the language is similar, and yet it's a very metaphysical. And then there's a huge thing about the connection between, as I said, between the relationship between the Son and the Father and naming and all of that, which basically comes up with the same thing, that we're all in it. We become one. We become unified through this process. That fear, evil, lack, error is not real. It doesn't have an existence separate from being the illusion of not knowing God. So when you're out of God, you get caught up in all this illusion. And when you're in God, all the illusion just dissolves and goes away.
Cool.
Do you have any other?
Nope.
In 5 minutes, or actually 10. The gospel.